Weekend in the Word, Friday night, 7 o'clock. We'll sing a little bit and then have a period of teaching. Don Truex is going to be speaking.
We'll run until about, what, 8:15, yeah, 30, probably. Somewhere.
I don't think he's as long-winded as you.
Probably not, but you never know.
Anyway, that's Friday night. And then Saturday, remember, we have this series of classes, 2 in the morning and then 1 after lunch.
10, 11, and 2.
Yeah. And we really would be very helpful if you guys would sign up, because right now it looks like 5 people are coming. And I'm confident that it's more than that. But this is a special thing. And we kind of need to know how many are going to be in each class. Remember, if you're going to be out here in the auditorium, there will always be that option, especially for those who don't want to be in a smaller room with COVID concerns. But we do have 2 additional classes going on. If you could take a moment as you go out there on the left to write your name underneath there, if you plan to attend, that will help us out a lot so we can anticipate what those class sizes are going to be like. And then Sunday's just regular, except David McClister is going to speak to
right.
us.
And then we'll wrap up Sunday night.
Yeah, Jeff and I are going to wrap up Sunday night and talk a little bit about what to do with everything we've learned over the weekend. So I hope you're really excited about that. It's a different approach to a special event. I don't know if we've ever done anything quite like that before.
No, it's a more interactive style gospel meeting, because with these class formats, it's a chance for people to speak and participate in the classes. And we have outside speakers and people you don't hear from normally as well. So hopefully there'll be something that's really beneficial to everybody.
So you're kind of saying save up those hard questions for McClister and Truex.
That's right.
Go to those classes, ask the questions while they're here.
Yeah.
I do think that's one of the interesting. Have you ever sat in a gospel meeting and heard something and wanted a follow-up?
Yeah.
I'd like to talk more about that. That's one of the benefits of this setting. We'll be able to do some of that kind of discussion. Okay, let's jump into the song tonight. We don't want to be too redundant, but it is really important tonight to set up 6 by talking about 5, right?
Right.
Do y'all remember chapter 5 from like 2 weeks ago? And we're on the other side of the honeymoon.
Right, real life. Real life is set in.
So you're saying prior to the honeymoon, it's not real life?
In our culture.
That's another conversation.
That's a whole nother. Yeah, don't get me started.
So the question that kind of hangs when you transition from 4 to 5 is, can romantic love continue?
Right.
Especially in light of sort of the obstacles and challenges that come to romantic love as we get into the real world of blending two lives.
See, real world, there you go. You did it too.
I know you're rubbing off on me.
I know. But but to your point, it's what happily ever after really looks like, not the movie Disney version, but the real life version. This is what it actually looks like. These are the obstacles. This is the work it takes.
So the first song we have at chapter 5, the first poem, is about a conflict between the two of them.
Yeah, and it seems to be, I think we kind of took it as, a little bit of her kind of having a dream or a nightmare, perhaps. Verse 2, I slept, but my heart was awake, a poetical way of describing a nightmare. And basically, she's, she and he are at odds.
And I think it's important that they seem to be at odds over sexual intimacy.
Yeah, he's asking to come in, and she's basically saying no.
Yeah, so... Maybe you're wondering we're teaching the high school kids the same book right now. Maybe you're wondering, like they are, why does sex keep coming up over and over again? And the answer is, it's what the book is about, folks. It's God's book on sexual intimacy. So, it's going to be that way all the way to the end, because that is what the book is trying to address. And so
sure. The
conflict here seems to be over sexual intimacy. Maybe it's hard to know how literal to take everything, but
sure. Maybe
an issue of timing and whether what's agreeable for one is agreeable for the other. But the problem creates some distance between
right. The
two of them. And in the poem, that's envisioned as him being lost. She can't find him.
And just one other way to take this, it is about the sexuality. But, given that and I think even last time we talked a little bit about different ways, we can get at odds in marriage. It can be timing. Someone's more in the mood and someone else is not, the other person's not. But part of it too is, at the end of the day, sexual intimacy in a marriage is kind of a barometer for what's going on, right? And so a lot of times even, that's kind of a sign that maybe there are other things. Because, as I think one writer well put it, sexual intimacy in marriage is kind of the oil that keeps the engine going. And I kind of like that image as far as, you know, it when it's there, things work well. When it goes away, things don't work as well.
That's interesting you would describe it that way, because...
Well, that was a writer. So I'm depending on what you do with this, it wasn't mine.
It's okay. I'm not going anywhere dangerous.
Okay.
I'm thinking back to what we said in the early poems produces that.
No, that's right.
Things like loving conversation, things like time together, things like sensitivity and caring about needs.
Right.
And that's what creates that desire for the physical relationship. And so when the physical relationship is lacking, maybe it's a reflection of there isn't a lot of meaningful conversation going on, or there isn't a lot of loving and caring between the two of them take place, not spending time together, which is often symptomatic of a deeper problem. I only hesitated because I'm tempted to figure out how far we're going to go down that trail, because there's a lot to be said about that.
Oh, absolutely.
Back in five, though, we have the two groups that help her figure this out. The first is the watchmen, who are mean to her. Y'all remember us talking about that?
Take away her veil and beat her.
As she looks for him, they are really harsh and violent toward her. And we talked about how that's a symbol for those forces in our life that hold us accountable and push us to do the right thing. And how sometimes when we're off the track and someone's trying to get us back right, it feels that way.
Right.
Almost like we're getting a beating, so to speak. And then the other group that helps her are the daughters of Jerusalem, who, let's look back at it. In chapter 5, verse 9, what kind of beloved is your beloved? Who is this guy that you've lost and cannot find? And remember, we talked about her list and how they're trying to get her to think about her list, which is the next piece, right? Picking up in chapter 5 in verse 10, she starts going through all of his wonderful attributes. And we talked about how important your list is to your happiness in marriage, because we keep lists on each other, right?
Either good ones or bad ones, but we are list makers.
That's exactly right. And sometimes what happens before marriage is we have this sort of unrealistic list of all of someone's good qualities. And then after marriage, we get this unrealistic list of their liabilities or their faults.
Right.
And so I think one of the things that gets us into trouble is minding the wrong list. And so the daughters of Jerusalem challenge her to take another look at the list, to appreciate his good qualities again.
And so what they're really doing is calling her back to an awareness. You know, sometimes we get stuck in those bad mental places where we focused on the negatives, and that self-talk in our head is in a bad place. And what we're saying to ourselves about the other person is in a bad place. And so what they're really doing is calling her back to an awareness of why she married him in the first place.
So with that said, that prepares us for six, where the daughters of Jerusalem are going to ask her a second question. Watch this, because it really kind of sets up the reconciliation, the two questions. In 5 and verse 9, it's, what kind of guy is this? What look are you, list are you looking at? And then in 6 and verse 1, it is, where has he gone? They pose these two questions to her. What kind of guy is this, and where has he gone? And there are different ways people understand that question. I've wondered if the point of the chorus is, well, if he's such a good guy, why can't you find him?
Right.
Or why does this separation exist between you?
And as you said, I mean, let's remember, right, this is poetry. This is not like prose. This is not an actual story. This is kind of a dream. And so it doesn't have to be literally he's physically gone somewhere. I mean, I think part of what we're both getting at is the idea is almost once you fix your attitude, he's right there. In other words, the relationship restores once she fixes her attitude, because when they ask her that question, the answer all of a sudden is...
Well, I don't get ahead.
I know.
Because we need to read that, right? So are you at chapter 6? Let's read... let's just take 1 through 3 first and talk about kind of this first section. So this is chapter 6, verse 1, and this is the daughters of Jerusalem speaking, who say, where has your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Where has your beloved turned, that we may seek him with you? And then she answers in verse 2.
And he's there.
My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of balsam, to pasture his flock in the gardens and gather lilies. I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine. He pastures his flock among the lilies. And so remember our three questions. We're going to work through these with this segment. First question is, what do you see? And at first glance, it looks like kind of a confusing mess for exactly what you said, right?
Right.
Because you have the question, and then all of a sudden, there he is.
Right.
And so we have the incorporation of the garden imagery. We'd probably have to talk about that first.
Well, yeah. I mean, in the garden, you know, we've seen that before in the book, right? It's been a fairly consistent image, whether it's the vineyards in the earlier chapters to... on the wedding night, you know, when she invites him into her garden.
Okay, so I think that's really important here.
Right.
Because she is the garden.
That's the point, is and inviting, you know, on the wedding night back at the end of chapter 4, beginning of chapter 5, when she invites him into the garden, that's her inviting him to consummate their marriage, finally sexually, you know, finally engage in sexual intimacy together. And now all of a sudden, that seems to be where she's at. She says, oh, he's in the garden. Once she fixes her attitude about him, then all of a sudden the intimacy returns, and now she knows exactly where he is, so to speak.
And then add to that, that in verse 3, he pastures his flock among the lilies. We've encountered that. Y'all remember that? We encountered that language too, back in chapter 2, in verse 16, where she is anticipating sexual intimacy with him.
Right.
This is pre-wedding, so not yet.
Right.
But that's what she's thinking about when that time comes. And so the very same language is used here. And so you put those two things together, and it sounds like we go from this conflict.
Right.
All of a sudden, he's back, and not only back, but they're intimate again with each
things
other.
Things are good.
So there's some stuff missing.
Well, in fact, you're back to the Eden imagery. In other words, it's all the way it should be, back in the garden with the lion laying down with the lamb, so to speak.
Well, what I want to know is, who won the fight? Aren't y'all wondering about that? Whose fault was it? And how did they work out the problem? You know, I'm reading verse 1 of chapter 6, expecting we're going to go through a search and they're going to find each other. And all of that is left out completely. The next thing we know, they're being sexually intimate again. And so Randy and Jeff have to remind me all the time, it's a poem, not a story. And better than that, it's a dream in a poem.
Right.
And you guys know how dreams are, right? Aren't dreams just like this? Missing pieces, they sort of pick up in the middle, and they don't always tell the complete story. They kind of jump around.
They have their own internal coherence. They just hold together for their own thing.
So remember, we've seen that before.
Yeah.
Remember at the end of chapter 3, there was all that dramatic buildup to the wedding. And then you get to chapter 4, and there's no wedding. They're already married.
And it's the wedding night.
It's the wedding night. That's exactly right. And so we've seen that same kind of leap before, and I think you have the same thing going on here.
And I think you can play with that even a little bit more, David, even within the flow, which is, you know, the issue is not what's important. It's the attitude towards each other that allows a couple to overcome whatever specific issues. Look, conflict's going to happen in a marriage. What keeps conflict from becoming catastrophic is the attitudes towards each other. And as the daughters of Jerusalem, you know, in this dream, whatever's going on in her head, as she's drawn back towards this, you know, why is your guy special? When she can fix her attitude, then the issue really isn't the issue, and the issue doesn't matter as such.
So if you wanted to put an umbrella over that, what we're really seeing is reconciliation. Mm. And it is important for this to be played out like a story. What the writer wants us to know is, yes, they had a problem, but they also come back together again. And because it's a book about sex, they are intimate again. The romantic love, the sexual intimacy survives the storm, in a sense.
The sexless marriage is not the restored marriage.
Right, right. So think about some things that might say to us about our own marriages. Because remember, at the end of the day, the book also needs to speak to us in a practical way, right? And so a couple of things about that. First of all, one of the things I thought about was, this is the way it's supposed to work, right? Because this is how God intended the relationship to be. You mentioned a moment ago that conflict is unavoidable.
Right.
And is going to be present in any relationship. Every marriage has issues, some more than other, but they're always there. In fact, can we agree that sometimes conflict is good? I worry about people that say they never argue, that they never get cross purposes with each other. I'm worried that somebody's holding out.
That's what I said. It means someone's not being honest.
Right. And worse than that, there's going to come a point in time where that's all going to come crashing down.
It's a volcano building up pressure till the explosion.
Exactly. Good figure. Good metaphor. And so better than that is to sort of vent those, get them on the table, work them out. But that's what we see happening here.
Right.
Conflicts are unavoidable. But what we see working its way through the poetry here is that they reconcile after the conflicts, that both parties reach a solution they can both be happy with.
And that sometimes outside help is necessary because of the role the watchmen and the daughters of Jerusalem play in that. In other words, you need the watchmen to hold you accountable to what the laws of the land are, so to speak. I mean, they're the enforcers, right? We talked about that last time. And then the daughters of Jerusalem are the peer group, you know, who again, you know, give them good advice, give her good advice in that particular case. But that sometimes, you know, there's a reason we get married in public, and there's a reason that everybody witnesses our marriage vows, and that's because sometimes it really does take a village. We're so autonomous in our culture, and we miss that sometimes.
A second thing that I thought about is I pondered the reconciliation that is envisioned in the poem is how important that is, because unresolved conflict has a way of destroying romantic love.
Our sex life is a barometer of the condition of our marriage.
Yeah, and some couples never settle anything, mm-mm, right? They argue, but they argue and argue and argue and never reach a solution. They just sort of stop talking about it until something else comes up and triggers another battle over the same issue that just sort of hangs around the house. I thought, for example, as an illustration of that, a couple who can never agree about what they're going to do with family over the holidays. That seemed fitting since the holidays are coming up. Who are you going to spend the holidays with? You know, some couples battle over that every year and never really work it out. So you just guarantee when Thanksgiving and Christmas come around, there's going to be a fight about whose family we're going to be with, because we never really resolve that. We never really reach a resolution and reconciliation over that kind of stuff. And when that happens, it just leaves bitterness that I think sours other parts of the relationship.
Right.
When you've got that unsettled conflict there, it doesn't just remain with that issue. It creeps out and finds its way into other parts of the marriage, including into feelings of romantic love and sexual intimacy.
Oh, absolutely.
Feelings are such a big part of that. And I think we saw that earlier in the book, where you have those kind words and that caring that all help to stir that up. But man, when you've got unresolved conflict, it just sort of injects bitterness into all of it. It's hard to feel romantic love for someone you have bitterness toward.
Right. And have come to see as an enemy.
I have used this illustration before. I don't think I have here. If I have, just kind of roll with me, would you? But I've tried to explain to couples that unresolved conflict is like leaving a bag of garbage in your house, right? I mean, we don't do that. We package up the garbage and we take it outside. Do y'all do that? Y'all can nod if that happens at your house, okay? Why don't you just leave it in the house? Because it stinks. That's exactly right. And that smell permeates everything. You can't be pleasant in your house when you're leaving bags of garbage laying around. I think that's what unresolved arguments are. They are these bags of garbage that people just leave laying around that wind up finding its way into everything else.
And the garbage winds up drawing other things as well. I mean, that's the thing. Garbage is like a magnet for vermin and other things. And so the rot literally
spreads. Why don't you make this vivid, man?
Well, we got six people, and it's interesting on Mondays and Thursdays. We try to get it all out of the house.
Jeff has like four garbage cans to go out to the curb.
Well, Joel always forgets one somehow. we're keeping that over the weekend.
So we've gone off on that tangent a little bit to say this. It is so important when these conflicts that are going to come do come that we find a way back together, that we find a way to reconcile. Now, you got ahead of me a minute ago.
I do that.
You do. It's okay, really. But that may require some help. So the daughters of Jerusalem
right.
help her. Mm-hmm. How do they help her?
And ironically, they don't lecture her. They give her that question that forces her to be honest. I mean, and I think that's important too. How the help comes matters sometimes. And that question that forces her to think carefully about why she married the guy. I mean, I think you've put it this way before. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, if you're unhappy in your marriage, well, what does it say about your decision-making when you married him in the first place?
Or if I develop this list of my spouse
right. That's
just loaded with a bunch of ugly negative qualities,
right. That's
a great question to ask. Well, what were you thinking when you married the guy?
That's right. That's right. And so at the end of the day, you really, you know, you've got to always put yourself in some way in the dock on this. But anyways, yeah, I mean, I just, you know, the apt question really is the way to force somebody, I think, a lot of times into either being honest or just revealing the fact that they're being stubborn and rebellious in their viewpoint in their marriage.
So I am tempted to kind of run a tangent there a little bit and talk
about...
It's
okay, I do it all the time.
And you're baiting me tonight. I don't know why you're doing that. But to talk about the value of giving wise counsel when people come to us. And I think sometimes what we do instead of giving wise counsel is we wind up siding with our friend and consoling them because of this difficult person they're with, rather than trying to help them see things like that, like the daughters of Jerusalem do here.
Right.
And then the other people we need to talk about are the watchmen.
Right.
Because they offer help too.
They do.
But a different kind of help.
Yeah, you need people in your life who will forcefully hold you accountable and say, you can't cross this line. You know, and in this case, I mean, literally the watchman almost telling her, you need to go home. It's that simple.
Right.
You need to go home. They take her veil away, her, you know, kind of her covering her ability to be out and about in decency as a woman. Is there a way of saying, no, we're not doing this, you go home. And we need people like that in our lives too, who tell us just sometimes, stop it. Just stop it.
That's a famous Jeff quote.
In some context.
Yes, yeah, that was in a sermon a while back. So where we're driving at with this is sometimes we need help. And so I think one of the messages that we'd like to really press tonight is don't be afraid to do that. No matter how long you've been married, no matter what the nature of the problem is, if you need help, first of all, confide in somebody. Someone who will tell you the right thing and encourage you to do right. Someone like a shepherd or maybe an older couple in the congregation that have a marriage you admire. Seek them out and ask for their help. Don't be intimidated or uncomfortable seeking professional help. Sometimes there are things that come up in marriage that require therapy with someone who knows what they're doing and managing those kinds of problems. And there is no shame in having a struggle you need some help with. I think I've said this before. I think I've shared this before, that I had a married couple come to me. It's been several years ago now. But, I mean, nobody was filing for divorce. Nobody was seeing a counselor. They just came by and said, okay, we've been arguing about this thing for 8 days. And we cannot come together. Would you listen to this and tell us what you think? And we just spent 2 hours that night talking about it. They just needed fresh perspective on it. And so confiding in someone, seeking help, I think, when we have struggles like this is really so valuable.
And just to underscore that, David, I think one of the interesting things about that scene there, you know, in chapter 5 with the watchmen, the daughters of Jerusalem, is it's not exceptional. It's part of the community. I mean, that's just how the community works. And again, we've become so privatized, it's nobody else's business, you know, whatever, that this is not how we were meant to live. The song represents more how we were meant to live, where there are watchmen and there are daughters of Jerusalem. There are people who know our business, and we talk to them and they talk to us and we nudge each other.
Though I think sometimes when people get defensive and say, that's not your business, it's usually because they're hearing something they don't want to hear.
Well, that's right. Yeah, that's
so,
right.
So that was the second thing I wrote down in my notes. Confide when you're struggling, but then when you go for counsel, listen. Because when there is a problem, we're often going to hear things we don't want to hear. And we need to be nudged in the right direction. And so don't make the mistake. Have you ever had this happen where someone came for counsel and they weren't really looking for counsel?
They were looking for affirmation.
Well, yeah, affirmation is a fancy way of saying they want you to take their side and beat up their spouse.
Right.
Right. I'm going to bring my spouse in here, and you're going to tell them how I'm right and they're wrong and set them straight.
Well, or they tell you your side of the story, wanting you to affirm that, you know, not realizing that, you know, was that old joke about there's really three sides to every story, his, hers, and the truth?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So when you get counsel, listen to the counsel that you're given. So a takeaway, I think, from these first three verses, as they come back together, is that's what's supposed to happen. Don't leave the bags of garbage laying around your house, because you get enough of those piled up and nobody wants to live in that house anymore.
Right.
It stinks. All right, let's take this next section, 4-10. Why don't you read this one? Because we have, well, I won't give it away. You listen as Jeff reads, and the question is, what do you see? Let's look at 4. We broke this up 4-10. Let's take
That's
a peek
right.
at it.
Yeah, so he then speaking to her, "You are beautiful as Tirzah, my love, lovely as Jerusalem, awesome as an army with banners. Turn away your eyes from me, for they overwhelm me. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes that have all come up from the washing. All of them bear twins, and not one among them has lost its young. Your cheeks are like halves of pomegranate behind your veil. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. But my dove, my perfect one, is the only one of her mother, pure to her who bore her. The young women saw her and called her blessed, the queens and concubines also, and they praised her. Who is this who looks down like the dawn, beautiful as the moon, bright as the sun, awesome as an army with banners?"
So what do you see? Does this ring familiar? It's another list. We've seen that before, haven't we?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, especially when they start using all that agricultural imagery and stuff that's odd to us. But it's a physical description. He's describing why she is so physically beautiful to him.
It's interesting to me that in this book of poetry, there are all these bullet lists. That just doesn't seem to go together for me.
Oh, they're more than bullet lists. I mean, this is poetry. This is Hallmark card stuff, just ancient Near Eastern style.
So remember, right here in this segment, we've already seen a list, her list of his good qualities.
Yeah, when she was called to think why she married the guy.
Right. And then we've had a list before that.
Oh, yeah.
Back in chapter 4, there is a lengthy list where he describes her on the wedding night. And so we get to 6 and we have another list, this time from him to her. And it's a familiar list in some ways, but a different list in some ways.
Yeah.
So when he opens in 4, he compares her to a couple of cities and then to an army with banners.
Yeah. And I think the point was just awesomeness. I mean, it's kind of, you know, remember when we invaded, Iraq back in the early 2000s? And that campaign was called Shock and Awe. You know, our military might, and the appearance of our military was going to overwhelm the Iraqis. This is the romantic version of Shock and Awe, I think. That's part of what he's really getting at. Beautiful cities and, and jaw-dropping like an army. I mean, look, he's a guy. I mean, that's, you know, he's still comparing it to guy stuff sometimes.
But I like that he's comparing it to guy stuff. I mean,
yeah, you know, it's just, you know, it's always the guy you feel sorry for him, bless his heart, when he's trying to praise his woman. You know, all he can do is compare her to a really nice car or something today. Or a really nice chariot back then.
I never compared my wife to a car. Not ever. That's interesting.
That's an interesting.
There's a marriage devotion sometime with guys. What kind of car is your wife?
Next men's weekend, Adam.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Mark that down. We'll do that.
Get it done, man. Get it done.
So there's that opening segment, and then picking up at 5, he starts talking about her physical features, and he mentions 4 things he's mentioned before: eyes, hair, teeth, temples.
Right.
Evidently, teeth were a thing back then.
You know, because the dentistry hadn't been invented yet.
They didn't have Chumley to help them out with the teeth.
Right.
So to have all of them evidently was really a pretty cool thing.
That's exactly right.
Oh, it was a different time. Now, 8 and 9,
yeah.
When he talks about the queens and the concubines, right?
He does. And virgins without number.
And it's a comparison there.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think it's the whole point. And 9 makes explicit what the comparison is. You know, even when you're surrounded by beautiful women, all desirable in their own way, remember, he's saying this to her, coming out, and the way we've kind of proposed it kind of collectively here, coming out of this, you know, as kind of an answer to this breakdown, you know, she has reaffirmed herself to him. She needs the security of him reaffirming himself to her. And here he is saying, you know, even when I'm, you know, even surrounded by beautiful women, I still only have eyes for you. You're still the one, the only one. And again, verse 9 is just double and triples down on that. And he uses even an intimate, you know, my dove, you know, his little pet name for her, as it were.
He's used that before.
Yeah, you know, kitten. No, you know, whatever you call your significant other. But my dove, my perfect one, only one of her mother, pure to her, her bore, pure there, I think, in the sense of just, you know, not messed up. I mean, just the only thing, something's important to you, something you keep pure, you keep separate, you don't get messed up. And so just the extreme, you know, no matter how many other desirable, beautiful women are available, you're the one.
Well, of course, the queens and concubines, mm-hmm, raise that conversation you and I have had many times, right?
Indeed.
Because y'all hear queens and concubines, and who do you think of? Yeah, you think of Solomon. And Jeff and I have had this running dialogue all the way through this class.
Oh, before this class.
Well, that's actually true, about whether or not the king, the groom, the husband is Solomon.
Right.
Jeff doesn't like that idea at all, by the way. I don't know that this really would suggest that.
No, this is one of those places that doesn't help the case, because
I don't think so.
Still saying you got 80 women and, you know, 80 available women in your bedchamber is not the way to reaffirm yourself to this one.
Yeah, and this kind of comparison, 60 queens, 80 concubines, virgins without number, that's really characteristic of the wisdom literature, setting
Correct.
Up this
Correct.
Comparison. By the way, it's never a good idea to compare your wife with someone else, right?
Yeah, because she's wanting to know why you're even thinking about that in the first place.
Except here to say she's better than them all, right?
That's right. In theory. You know, not that I would know.
Probably the safe way to say that.
Exactly.
So anyway, and then the list comes back, this time in verse 10, comparing her to the dawn, the moon, and the sun, and back to an army with banners. Interesting that it's kind of bookended.
Correct.
And bookended with the army with banners. Evidently, Correct. He is fond of that figure
Correct.
At this point.
Yeah, that's why verse 10 makes a nice stopping place, because it does bookend like that. And and that's the thing is, and so he opens in verse 4, but the repetition of the phrase points us to this. He's actually doing the same thing too, though, with slightly different imagery, which is just saying, you are beautiful to me. You know, beautiful cities. We don't, you know, usually compare our significant other cities, but they did back then, really, really good looking cities. Tyre is a beautiful place up in the north. Jerusalem is Jerusalem, beautiful to a God-fearing person. And the same thing now here, rather than something man-made, it's something God made. The dawn, the moon, the sun, and still awesome as an army because he's a guy and she's still a really good car, apparently.
I'm not touching that. I'm leaving that alone.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about why this list is here. Mm-hmm. Because if we are correct in connecting this to what has gone before, this is our second list, mm-hmm, in this reconciliation.
Yeah.
She had her list of his good qualities. She needed a nudge to remember that. But it seems to me this list is here for a different reason, that this isn't just him remembering her good qualities.
No.
But that what it really is saying is that conflict has not destroyed the romantic love. It hasn't changed the way that he feels about her. In fact, it's interesting
Right.
to me that he uses some of the very same language that he used on the wedding night to describe her. And I wonder if that's intentional in a sense as to say, I feel about you just like I felt about you at the beginning.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, if we're reading this in, you know, kind of from 5-2, and her kind of rejection of him, then through all that, like we've been doing, then that's the thing is, you know, her list is about, you know, kind of falling back in love, you know, changing her mind and her heart. His role in this is to say, I'm still here and nothing has changed. I still want you and I still think you are amazing.
Yeah, which then comes back to that statement in verse 9 where he says, my dove, my unique one, or my only one.
Right.
that kind of takes me back to things he said about her before, back in chapter 1. You're the prize horse.
Yep.
Of all the flowers, you are the most. Your thorn, they're all thorns compared to you.
Yeah, and that's right.
Kind of what he does here as well.
Only one of her mother. Even if you had sisters, I'm only looking at you.
So in a way, her list is a reminder to see his good qualities. His list is a reminder that even though we've been through this, how I feel about you hasn't changed.
Right. And recognizing that in reconciliation, there's something each side needs to do. The one who, is kind of on the outs needs to fix their mind, their attitude, whatever. The one who maybe didn't really go anywhere needs to be ready to reaffirm that this is still good. We're still good. And all is well.
That segues nicely for us into our third question about how we apply all of this. And that's kind of what I was thinking about, that conflict doesn't have to destroy romantic love. That really, it boils down to how we choose to deal with it. And candidly, folks, some people just deal with conflict badly. They don't manage it well. They wind up with all those bags of garbage and the house stinks. And eventually, in the case of some, sadly, smell so bad that everybody wants out. And they wind up abandoning the relationship, not because it couldn't be salvaged, but I think often because they don't know how to salvage it. I think managing conflict is a learned skill rooted in principles from God's word. And when we don't know how to do it well, we need help to do better.
And part of that, David, I think is, we've been trained in our society, to kind of put emotions first, and your emotions have to, those are the real guy. That's the real you. That's the authentic you. And you'll notice, whether it's the Daughters of Jerusalem and the question they ask to kind of get her back on track, they're engaging the mind over how you feel. In other words, they're not enabling her in her emotions. They're not joining her and bashing him or whatever it is. But what has to happen is we have to re-engage the mind over the emotions. I may not feel like this. I need to do what's right. I may not feel like this. Honor the commitment. And there literally is a way. I think we don't do this as much as we should or could. And a lot of us, we haven't done it enough to realize that there is an element of truth to this. But by telling yourself what you need to believe and feel, you can actually, you can discipline your emotions. You can train your emotions. We do that with our kids, don't we? Don't we expect our kids, when our kids get angry, when our kids are hateful, when our kids don't feel like something, don't we discipline our kids towards training their emotions? Well, folks, it's no different for us in learning to do marriage or do any other adult bit. Mm-hmm. And so all of this, part of this getting on back on track is demoting the emotions, ironically, to get back to true, genuine, romantic emotions.
Yeah, but that's part of learning how to do it, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
Which to me says there is a teaching dimension to this. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes people are raised in dysfunctional homes, or let me say it a different way. They're raised in the shadow of a dysfunctional marriage. So maybe mom and dad never managed conflict well. And that's all I learned is people who did it badly, but I didn't know they were doing it badly. That's right. Just how I learned married couples argued and, right. and fought with each other. And so there is a teaching role to help people learn something new and better and different to manage conflict better. God certainly knew that we were going to fuss with each other. I mean, he didn't design marriage and thinking, oh my, that didn't work out very well. He knew there would be conflict and discord and friction.
Well, that's why he had to say you can't divorce, because he knew that's what, the temptation would be to fly apart.
Right, but if he knew that, then we can expect that he would also provide what we would need to do that better. And so what I would say is, if you find yourself in that place, ask for help. There's probably some teaching that would go a long way to help us manage those kind of things better. The other thing that I really liked, especially in this listing segment, also in her words, is that they seem to process the conflict through the lens of permanence. I think that's really important. Do y'all see that? Do you see the sense of permanence they have? Look at her words in verse 3 of chapter 6. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. We belong together, right. She says. And then in chapter 6 and verse 9, that statement you alluded to, but my dove, my perfect one, is unique, or as his other translated, is the one.
Right.
This is the one for me. Again, same idea. We belong together.
Right.
And it's, so there is that sense of permanence through which they seem to be processing all of this.
Yeah, I mean, there is no hint of any kind of permanent or significant separation. The garden will be preserved.
I don't know that we always do that when we have conflict, especially when it's bad. I wonder sometimes if instead of affirming permanence, we question permanence.
Oh, yeah.
Part of that is the soulmate problem. Why, if we can't get along, maybe we didn't belong together.
Right. There's
the first
that
place.
One right person that we're just going to click. And when I find the right person, there will be no conflict.
Right. And so we ought to be clear in verse 9, when he says, you're the one, it doesn't mean that she was his soulmate and the only one destined for him.
Yeah.
She's the one he chose to be her one and only.
And he's affirming commitment to the choice. All of this, you know, as far as all this goes, it's about choice. I mean, ironically, as much as we say, you know, it's not my body, my choice. The irony is, here it is. It's about you made the choice for this person. And once you make the choice, there's no takebacks. And so you literally have to put mind, will over any other feelings, negative feelings, get them out. Because to honor God and do right, there is no change now. You have to keep the choice you made.
Well, sometimes that isn't reflected when we're not in a good place with each other. And instead of reflecting that permanence, we reflect doubt. Maybe instead of working this out, maybe we'll just make an exit. So we need to not ever do that.
Right.
Because I think saying it legitimizes it.
Well, sure. And now we're back to that negative self-talk that the daughters of Jerusalem just got her out of there. You know, go back and remember why you did, not why you shouldn't have. And because once it's done, it's done. And so the only way forward pleasing God is, why did I do this? You know, in the good sense of that, remembering why I did this and focusing on that and nurturing that.
So I think we shouldn't create an option that doesn't exist.
Right.
That maybe instead of fixing this, we'll just walk away.
Right.
Because I think that changes our view of the problem, doesn't it?
Oh, sure.
What we're going to do with the problem. Because maybe I won't work on this.
Right.
Maybe I'll just choose to walk away.
Right.
And so since we're both committed to God's will, I think that's what needs to be affirmed in the words we speak to each other.
Right.
Because frankly, if we say to our spouse, you are mine and I am yours, you are the one, now we've got to fix the problem.
Once you're on a boat in the middle of the ocean, there's only one thing to do when there's a leak, and it's bail it and fix it. You're not leaving the boat for somewhere else. She's not leaving the boat for somewhere else. Once you're on the boat in the ocean in the storm.
So you're kind of saying marriage is like being stranded on a boat with someone?
It's poetry. It's just an image.
But I like it. I think that's exactly right.
Yeah. It there's nowhere
to go. It only leaves us the option of addressing the problem.
That's right. Bail it out, patch the leak, and keep rowing.
And I want to say that I think we need to be optimistic about our ability to do that. Maybe sometimes we struggle with that because we look at our problems only from the perspective of what we can do by our power and wisdom.
Yeah.
Which may not be very much.
Right. Or even more without changing ourselves. I mean, that's the thing. We want the other person to change, but we never say, what am I willing to change? And so going back to, again, it's all just on the human level, and that's the part of the problem.
But we don't face anything that's too big for God. Mm-mm. And with his wisdom to guide us, I think we can overcome anything. We did have a question. Someone said, can the sin of selfishness hinder reconciliation?
Say that one more time.
Can the sin of selfishness hinder reconciliation?
Yes.
Yes, we'll move on.
Of course it does.
I wonder if you could even argue that that may be the greatest problem that pulls us apart.
Or it's cousin pride. I mean, that's, you know, the person who doesn't want to admit they were wrong or that they got it wrong or something like that. I mean, pride's, you know, however you want to spin those two. But yeah, I mean, both are self-oriented sins where the self's desires, the self's wants, and the self's image are at the center.
Yeah, I think that oneness plays a role in this, that we become one flesh with our spouse. And so that doesn't allow me in marriage to make it just about me. I'm not saying that's easy. I know that's a battle, okay? That's a great struggle. But that is the struggle. We wrestle to not just think about self, but to see us as one, and we act for the good of the team, not for me individually.
Right.
And so when we stop doing that, I think it winds up pulling us apart.
Well, and that's the thing is, you know, I even think about, you know, jump around somewhere else, but Paul's image in Ephesians, you know, where once you're married, you know, husbands, it's your, you know, she is your body. You know, she is as much you as you are you. And so that to your point, that oneness, you can't not think about her if you're a husband in a way that says it's me versus her, because she is you once you're married.
And the challenge is even deeper than that, because the challenge of the unselfish spirit that disciples are to have is not just to think about the other guy too. It's to think about the other guy before me, to put their needs before my own, especially in our marriage. So, hey, we got 5 minutes and we got to deal with 11 through 13. Will y'all look at that, chapter 6?
I was trying to set that break up where I wanted it.
What's that?
I was trying to set that break up
you're trying to drag this out. That's exactly right.
Run the clock out.
Let's read 11, 12, and 13. We're going to do a couple of things with that tonight. 11, this is the bride speaking again, and she says, I went down to the orchard of nut trees to see the blossoms of the valley, to see whether the vine had budded or the pomegranates had bloomed. Before I was aware, my soul set me over the chariots of my noble people. Come back, O Shulamite, come back that we may gaze at you. Why should you gaze at the Shulamite as at the dance of the two companies? Yeah, what do y'all think about that? Same kind of bizarre, I have no idea what's going on there. So let me just say a word, particularly about what I think is happening in verses 11 and 12, and then we'll work a little bit with 13. Jeff and I have two views of this, though I think we're partial to each other's views as well.
They're not necessarily contradictory.
Yeah, exactly. It's poetry, and it all just kind of depends on how you read this. In my mind, 11 and 12 are sort of the conclusion of this whole series of poems about their conflict. We have seen this idea of blooming and budding before. Remember back in chapter 2, as their relationship is blooming, he invites her out on a spring day and they see all the plants flowering in the springtime. And we describe that as sort of a metaphor for the growing love and affection that they have for each other. And I think what's happening in 11 is we're revisiting that again. And what she's saying is, I went to go see if it was going to be springtime again. After this ugly thing that we've been through, can the vineyard bloom again? And what does she find? That it can. And so after you're married and after you've been through the trouble, it can be springtime again. And I think that's what she's saying. And I think it's a great lesson for us to remember as well. You know, the devil would like to convince you that problems are too big to be fixed. Love is dead. It can never be rekindled. You know, it's over with and it's hopeless. And I think verse 11 is saying that's absolutely not true. That you can work through your problems. You can have springtime again. But now you see a different connection perhaps here.
Yeah, I think one of the other things, and again, I, like we talked about, you and I have talked about, you know, sometimes in poetry and just the way the Old Testament, even in the narrative sections, you have hinge points where it's really kind of, it's concluding and starting the next section. And I think there's a way in which you could read this as the opening of chapter 7. You know, verses 4 and 10 bookend each other so nicely. That's the wrap up there. We're starting something new here. To your point, she's going back out. She's looking for springtime. She's looking for this new life. And then we talk about, you know, that's the image of spring, right? New life, you know, young love. But now they're married. What does this new marriage look like as you go out? And that's part of what you do with 13. You know, the man seems to jump in there in the second half of verse 13. Why? Well, go back. Beginning of verse 13, the daughters of Jerusalem want her to run with them still, but she can't now. She's married. She can't. And not only that, but he doesn't want her acting certain ways in public anymore. Why should you look upon the Shulamite as upon a dance before two armies? Depending on your translation. You know, there are certain things you do when you're single you don't do when you're married anymore, right? And so And so what's going on here is him kind of protective of her sexual nature, her sexual desirability, her having a different group. You know, the marriage is the front and center now. And so he comes on, ironically, in chapter 7, where we'll be next time we do this, to not only calling her to him and just to him, you got to leave the daughters of Jerusalem behind. You're not a virgin anymore. You're not one of the single ladies. But honestly, the most intimate physical description that we've had in the song, in which, again, he's emphasizing the intimacy of their relationship in this new springtime, this new marriage, over the life that she used to live and is being tempted back to. Things change once you get married. You can't kind of run around with the boys on Friday night anymore. You can't run around with the girls on Friday night. You've got a different relationship, different responsibility. And so it may well hinge kind of ending one section, beginning the other. But we'll have to talk about that a little bit more next time.
Yeah, so that's 2 weeks.
Next week,
we're going to be wrapping up our weekend in the Word and talking about some takeaways from our studies. And then 2 weeks, we'll be back to the song and we'll be looking at chapter 7. I'm going to close with a prayer. Before we do, a quick reminder, as you go out on the left, there's those sign-up sheets. If we could get everybody to sign up for the class they plan to attend on Saturday, it'd be a great help to us. We really appreciate that. Let's pray together. God, we're grateful for the privilege of considering these poems that show us how to be one even after we've struggled in our marriage. We pray you will help us to do that. In Jesus' name, amen.